It's Issues and Ideas. I'm Marisa Waddell with you, and my guest today is Garrison Keillor, the humorist and author and host of A Prairie Home Companion and The Writer's Almanac. He's getting ready for his radio romance tour in July and August, and that includes a stop in Paso Robles at the Vina Robles Amphitheater on July 14th. Welcome, Garrison Keillor.
Hello, don't think I've ever been to Paso Robles before.
You haven't, but you've been very nearby in San Luis Obispo.
That's right.
Which is where KCBX is located. Mm-hmm. And Paso Robles is a wonderful place, too, and so we'll be happy to have you. How is your summer going so far? Are you enjoying yourself?
It's just arrived in Minnesota. We've just begun summer. We've had two absolutely ideal summer days and summer evenings, and I suppose we should be content with that, but we hope for more.
Well, when you get to Paso Robles, it will be warm.
All right, I will plan on that. I will bring a short sleeve shirt, especially for Paso Robles.
So what made you decide to call your tour the Radio Romance Tour? What's romantic about it?
Well, we're radio people, and that's what we do, and some of what's on the show is from our radio show, but there's a little more romance to it because I have a chance to go out and sing duets with Aoife O'Donovan, who's a fabulous singer and a great duet singer. She just has this gorgeous ear, and she's able to entwine her voice around just about anything that the other person does. To me, that's the idea of a romance, entwining.
She has a wonderful new CD out. I'm wondering how you select special guests like Aoife who will appear on the program with you.
Well, we want somebody who's going to be a lot of fun and who's a trooper. We're doing a long tour. It's 26 cities in 30 days. So you want somebody who can hold up to that. And she is. She's made of firm but pliable stuff.
I'm always impressed that wherever you go, you always know things about the town you're in that only the locals might know, and that you're able to make the locals laugh at themselves about their town's quirkiness or unique characteristics. And I'm wondering how you do that. Do you have spies?
I do have spies. And I don't know anything at this point about Paso Robles, but there's time. We'll land in town in the early afternoon, and the show's at night, and so there's time.
We like to share here at KCBX, so we put out a call for our listeners to send in questions for you. And I have one here from George Asdell in Atascadero, which is very near Paso Robles. He's wondering, what is your process for writing poetry and song lyrics? Specifically, he's wondering about the tools you use, like pen and pencil on paper, or electronic tools, rhyming dictionaries, thesaurus. What's your process?
I use pen and paper, a legal pad, and I have a few favorite kinds of pens that I favor, and I can't really use anything but those. They're rollerball pens. But the main thing is that you can't force anything. So if you're writing a lyric, there will be a number of times when you simply have to put it down and set it aside and wait for another time.
So it's a longer process. Just bits and pieces come out as the spirit lets it?
It comes when it comes. And what people call talent, I think, is really a facility that oftentimes will lead you in the wrong direction. So you have to resist yourself, and you have to frustrate your own tendencies to take it in certain directions. A lyric, it has to be free. It has to come of its own will, and it can't come at your bidding.
Well, here's one from Eileen Hervey, who lives in Orcutt. She says, like you, I'm an English major and have read and dabbled in poetry most of my life. She starts her weekday mornings at KCBX with Writer's Almanac, and she says that your daily poem has introduced her to some fine poets. Here's what she's asking. Do you see poetry taking on a new life in today's high-tech, low-touch culture?
Well, the high-tech culture has succeeded in getting poetry around to places where it might not otherwise have gone. The ease with which you can go online and Google the name of a poet or a subject, it's just astonishing to an older person. And so you can pull up so many things that are just at your fingertips now. So it's really up to individuals, as it always has been. And if someone has a need for poetry, they'll find it. And if not, well then, God bless them, and I hope they find something else.
Darlene Tunney from Shell Beach wants to know what you do for fun to refresh yourself.
I work is what I do, if you want to know the truth. I sit down and I write. I've been writing since I was a teenager, and that's 50-some years ago. It really has held up in my life, and I don't feel the need for a hobby. I don't need to collect anything. I travel, of course, but usually for the show.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Marisa Waddell speaking with Garrison Keillor, who is getting ready to go on his Radio Romance Tour in July and August, and he'll be stopping nearby in Paso Robles at the Vina Robles Amphitheater on July 14th. Garrison, here's a question from Mark Gaskell of Grover Beach. He wants to know how you prepare for your monologue on A Prairie Home Companion, and he's also asking, what percent is it, ad lib or improv?
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't know that I can put a percentage to it. But a lot of it can be improv. But the secret to improvisation is to have prepared something already, and then you can improve on it by improv and invent something better.
Here's something from Sue McGinty from Los Osos. She would like you to comment on the current state of gridlock in the U.S. Congress.
If Congress is gridlocked, it's because we tolerate this and because we have no pressing need for Congress to do anything. And so they can amuse themselves in partisan byplay. Congress has been more gridlocked and more partisan at times in our history. You look back at the early 19th century, the time leading up to the Civil War, and it was just unbelievably angry and bitter and virulent. So what we have today is a time when Congress is just sort of irrelevant, and it just doesn't make a whole lot of difference to my life and most other people's lives.
Claire Hawkins in San Luis Obispo notes that you have a great many Yo Mama jokes, and she says that they seem a rather unusual choice of humor on your part, since they usually are assumed to be racial or play on stereotypes, though she knows that isn't necessarily true all the time. She wants to know how you got interested in Yo Mama jokes. What is it about them that attracts you to them? And do you have a favorite that you might like to share with us?
Well, we got into the Yo Mama jokes because we were doing joke shows. So they were always part of that. I'm interested in them because I never knew that humor growing up. It's insult humor. And she's right. It is, a lot of it comes from African-American kids, city kids playing a little game called the Dozens, in which you would go back and forth and try to come up with, top each other. Something even more insulting. I can't say I have a favorite Yo Mama joke, but there are categories of them. Your mama is so fat. Your mama is so old. Your mama is so ugly. You know, your mama's so fat, she has her own zip code. You know, your mama's so ugly, you know, she scared George Washington when she put the dollar bill in her pocket. he tried to jump off. You know, your mama's so old. She was in the third grade with Jesus. It's a kind of, you know, raw, childish humor that I never knew, and so I find it interesting.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Marisa Waddell, and my guest today is Garrison Keillor, who will be stopping in Paso Robles on July 14th with a Prairie Home Companion and the Radio Romance Tour. That's the 14th of July at the Vina Robles Amphitheater. Linda Ashworth from Morro Bay wants to know if you ever get tired of coming up with ideas for Lake Wobegon.
I don't really have to think about it. I simply have them in mind, and things come. I pick up information just walking around and overhearing people. I'm very suggestible when I hear people talking about an upcoming wedding, and that's interesting. And so the next week, somebody will be getting married in Lake Wobegon, and the bride's family will be worried about the cost of it and how many people we're inviting and so forth. I will hear about a dispute in a small town about an ordinance forbidding chickens. So chickens, that would be interesting to bring that into Lake Wobegon. Just, you walk around and you attract all these little metal filings of little bits of stories and characters, and out of that you just, through some simple natural process, you know, like a spider making a web, you do it, that's all.
Chuck Dowdle from Cambria graduated from St. John's University in Collegeville, Minnesota in 1952, and he's wondering where and when you got your start with Minnesota Public Radio. He's specifically wondering if St. John's University played any part in its beginning.
I started with Minnesota Public Radio in 1969 in the fall. That was my last job interview, was going up to St. John's University and sitting in the office in Wimmer Hall of a man who was my age, but he was the president of Minnesota Public Radio, Bill Kling. And he wore a suit and a tie and a white shirt. And I wore jeans and Red Wing boots and a black T-shirt and a sport coat. And I had somewhat long hair and I had a beard. We sat and we talked about radio. And he hired me. I think he hired me because I was willing to work the early morning shift. And I think he hadn't found anybody else who would do that. And so, if you're willing to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, you can get into radio. That's the lesson I take from that.
Mickey Gilman from San Luis Obispo and Atascadero says that she was shocked to hear another voice on Writer's Almanac. And so it made her wonder, what are your plans for your retirement? When will it be? What will it look like? And what are we, your fans, going to do without your soothing voice telling us profound things about life and many funny things?
Billy Collins, a great poet, has come in as a favor and is doing 3 months of the Writer's Almanac while I'm off doing the summer tour. And then I'm going over to Italy in August, and then I'll be back with the Writer's Almanac in September, and I assume for some time to come. I really enjoy doing it, and I have no plans for retirement. I passed retirement age, you know, a few years back, and I thought about it, but I just couldn't think of anything I could do that would be as much fun and as interesting as what I do now. So I'm just hanging on. I'm just sitting, you know, under my fig tree and working away at what I've always done and, you know, waiting for the cougar to jump out and grab me, but he hasn't yet. So I'm fine. You just don't think about it. I don't think about it that much anymore. I used to think about it, you know, when I was your age, when I was very young. I thought about how does the end come and so forth. I always thought I was going to die young when I was in my 20s, like all those people who did, you know, like James Dean and Janis Joplin and all of those. And I got to be 40, and that's too old to die young. And so then you just keep on going.
Garrison Keillor will be stopping in Paso Robles on July 14th, along with a Prairie Home Companion and his Radio Romance Tour. It'll be at the Vina Robles Amphitheater on July 14th. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us, Garrison Keillor.
My pleasure. And now do I get to ask one question?
Yes.
Are you related to the great Philadelphia baseball player Rube Waddell?
You know, there's a chance. There's a chance that I'm related, but I don't know for sure.
Let me just give you some advice here, Marisa. In the future, if someone asks you this question, say yes. Just say yes, and then you can make a story out of it.
That's good advice. I'll have to think up my story.
Yeah, it was a long time ago, so he might have been your great-great-great-grandfather. Rube Waddell, he was a great colorful character. Somebody's going to ask you this question in the next year, I predict. The answer is yes.
Okay. I'll work on that. And in fact, I'll probably go ask my father.
Good. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Garrison, and I'll see you in July.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I'm Donna Cheek with Issues and Ideas. Today, my guests are Jeanette Burrows, a therapeutic bodywork specialist, and Linda Plum, the executive director of Red Wings Horse Sanctuary. Thank you both for joining me today. Jeanette, do you realize how far back you and I go?
No, I don't. It's a long ways, that's for sure.
I opened my business in 2001.
Okay.
You have come for I don't know how many horses.
I don't either.
You've worked on two of my dogs.
Yes.
None of my cats, though. Do you work on cats?
I do. There isn't anything that isn't alive or moving that I don't work on or won't work on.
That brings me to my first question.
Okay.
What is it that you do?
Well, I call it therapeutic body work. I do a variety of different things, from massage to cranial sacral to acupressure and applied kinesiology. I mean, the list goes on. So I've been in the business now for about 18 years.
So when you were mentioning all of those modalities, those are applicable to just animals, just people? How does that work?
All of the above. All humans, all animals can benefit from some kind of therapeutic body work. Just living. If you have dogs that run a lot, or if you have horses that are in competition, just like humans, you know.
How does it differ if you're going to be working on a horse compared to a human? What is that difference like?
Absolutely. That's very true. I have a lot of skills with animals. Grew up with horses, so, and a lot of other farm animals as well. So if I'm working with dogs or cats and they're predators, and then I'm working with horses or ducks, their prey. So your approach is a little different,
right?
You know, so all of those things come into play. And I have very good intuitive skills. And so my approach with the animals are a little different. A human, I can explain to you what I'm doing, what to expect. With animals, you have to get their permission.
Interesting. You mentioned ducks.
Ducks. Yep.
Why would a person call you about a duck needing body work?
Well, the nerve that ran down this particular duck's leg had become pinched or impinged by the pelvis from laying eggs. And so she started dragging her foot backwards as she was walking and taking the tissue off the top of the foot. So I worked with the pelvis doing some cranial sacral work, and now she's walking back like she used to be.
Did she like it?
Yeah, you know, at first I think she was a little apprehensive, but I actually was able to roll her onto her back and work with her. She got very comfortable. So
You rolled the duck on her back with her little web feet up in the air?
I have pictures.
Yeah, I have to see the pictures. I know when you work on a dog and there's the deep sighing that takes place when they relax into you. What does a duck do?
The animal is no longer tense in your hands. There's a sense of relinquishing themselves to you. And I wait for that. I never hurry it. And so I think that's probably one of the reasons that it works well with so many different kinds of animals, is just being patient and waiting for that moment where they're saying, remember I said you have to ask permission.
Yes.
The minute that permission comes, then you can go ahead and start to do your work.
That's so interesting. Is a duck the most unusual animal that you've done treatment
See, and I don't
on?
Think the ducks what? Are unusual. But yeah, I've done...
Really? Why do you not think ducks are unusual? Because first of all, I would imagine dragging the foot would be pretty obvious.
Yeah.
Does this duck have a family and a last name?
It has a family and a last name.
Okay. It okay.
It's a pet duck.
Wait a minute. Didn't you work on a turtle at
one... tortoise. A three-legged tortoise. Correct. Okay. He was starting to spin in a circle a little bit too much, and so thought I could help him out a little bit, and actually did.
You are doing work with Red Wings Horse Sanctuary, and
yes.
I'm very curious to know, first, how did that get started?
It got started when I was given a call about an Arab mare that they had there who had been badly abused. Linda can tell you more about her story.
This is the perfect time
yeah.
for me to bring in Linda. Linda, I'm so glad that you came in to talk with me today. And I want to find out about the horse situation that Jeanette had just mentioned. What was the situation with this horse that prompted you to call her?
Well, at Red Wings, we take abused, neglected, and abandoned horses. And this particular horse came in because she had been badly abused, as Jeanette mentioned. And she had been beaten with a 2x4, and it had caused severe damage to her. And we worked with her, but she wasn't responding particularly well. And so we looked for somebody with expertise in this area, and we found Jeanette, who came out and within minutes had this horse, Pearl was her name, responding, because this horse was troubled. Not only did she suffer the physical abuse, but she had psychological issues going on as well. Mm-hmm. And so to see her connect with a human
yes.
the way she did so quickly was a miracle. And then Jeanette came to us and said, I have an idea. And so Jeanette started offering us the opportunity to have her link to our volunteer training classes. So we have volunteer training classes where we have people who are interested in helping at the ranch come and learn basics. And then okay. Jeanette works with them in the afternoon to learn some of these techniques with some of our neediest horses.
That's nice. I, for one, have seen the facility firsthand. You gave me a tour. And I must say I was pleasantly surprised with how happy and plump these horses are. I mean, having been in the business for a long time, I know when a horse is in distress. And these horses were really, really happy. I was so impressed with how clean and orderly the place was. And so can you tell us the difference between a sanctuary and a rescue?
I can. And in fact, I can give you a little history. Because when we started out in 1991, we did rescue and retrain and rehome. And generally speaking, that's what a rescue does. They go out, they find these animals that are in distress, they bring them in, they try to rehabilitate them and find them good homes. And that's what we did in 1991. But within a couple years, we were starting to see some of our horses go back onto sales lots. And that was not the goal. The goal was to have these horses in good, stable homes. Consequently, the people who were involved at that time went back to the drawing board and said, we are going to do something different here. We're going to reevaluate our mission, and we are going to become a sanctuary, meaning that we would take horses and give them a forever home.
I'm Donna Cheek with Issues and Ideas. We are talking today to Jeanette Burrows, a therapeutic bodywork specialist, and Linda Plum, the executive director of Red Wings Horse Sanctuary. I'm sure that both of you have experienced a lot of horses coming through there. Is there one particular horse and its story that stands out?
Oh, boy. For me, it's really hard because I find that every single horse that comes in has some story that pulls on your heartstrings. And for instance, we have one who is a wonderful old gent, and his name is Champ. He's 33 years old, and we only got him about 3 years ago. And Champ's story was abandonment. He had been left behind on property that had been sold to a winery And the winery clearly didn't want him. They'd bought the property to plant grapes.
Right.
And luckily there was a woman in the area, contacted us. We were able to go through the legal process and bring Champ to Red Wings. And here was a horse who had done nothing wrong, and he would have just been left to starve to death. And he's one of our meeters and greeters, if you will. He's one of the first horses people see, and they just fall in love with him.
That's nice.
Champ.
And he has a very special volunteer, a young woman who comes out. She's part of a military family in the neighborhood, and mm-hmm. she's doing the body work on Champ now. And she has made huge changes for him. I think it was the second time that I came out. He took off and running and bucking and carrying on. And I says, oh, my goodness, you fixed him so well. We can't even catch him.
Oh,
and
that's nice.
It was cute.
That's very
and
nice.
And she's so proud of the work she's done, and she should be. He's come a long way.
I am struck by the fact that these horses aren't there just in storage.
No.
These horses are there to have a quality of life that is the best the two of you can provide. And that is what I want people to realize, that these horses weren't there parked, being thrown hay, and that's it. These horses are given an opportunity to not only have love and attention for the rest of their days, but also to enjoy a physicality that maybe would not have been available to them.
Absolutely. That's why the volunteers are so important.
That's
so
nice.
The more that we can keep that program going where we've got the people coming in doing that, I think the best for Red Wings will continue to happen.
Where is Red Wings located so that our listeners can get an idea?
Red Wings is now located near Lockwood. We're about 20 miles north of Paso Robles on 101 and then 15 miles northwest near Lockwood. So if people know where Lake San Antonio is or Fort Hunter Liggett, and that's where our military volunteers come from, Mission San Antonio, those are all nearby locations. And we have a 160-acre ranch out there. We love to have company, and we love to have visitors and volunteers.
For those that are listening, what could they do to help?
When you're working with a 501c3 like we are, the priority is always the support of individual donors. We are completely supported by giving, and our budget is fairly hefty because we have 85 horses on that ranch. One thing I'd like to add to what you said earlier is, yes, the horses are there, and their quality of life is improving, and they act as ambassadors. They, too, are part of the educational program. We use their stories to help teach people about horses so that in the end, we'd love places like us to no longer exist.
So the education component of the program is to, what is the focus?
The focus really is if you are going to take on the responsibility of horse ownership, I would say probably half of the horses at Red Wings, people started out getting these horses with great intentions, but they didn't realize they need shoes, they need their teeth taken care of, they need doctor's appointments for vaccinations, and oh, by the way, they can live to be 30 years old just like Champ. And people go into owning a horse not necessarily thinking about that commitment.
Well, there's a romantic notion to owning a horse that I have run into. People have this idea that, oh, I want my daughter to have a horse because I never had one when I was a child, or they're older and they say, well, I did not have one as a child, so I want one now. So I have run into that. So the priority is raising funds.
You know, along with those priorities of fundraising, we've been talking a lot about volunteering, and that is also very important.
And if there's an event planner out there who would like to come and volunteer with some great ideas, all of the anybody that wants to volunteer that has skills outside of rescuing horses could be used. So if there's an event planner out there that has an idea on how Red Wings can raise some money some way, that would be a fabulous thing. If there's somebody out there doing that and wants to volunteer, that'd be great.
So pretty much if a person has an interest in a love for resources, a willingness to spend time. It could be virtually anything. I noticed in the brochure, it could be someone who is a builder or a carpentry. It could be someone working in the office. It
welding.
Could be welding. So, mm-hmm. So really, whatever skill a person has, if they have the desire, then Red Wings would welcome them
with open arms.
Absolutely.
And the horses will be welcoming them as also. Who is the ambassador? What horse is the one that greets people? That is
Champ.
Champ. So Champ will be the first greeter to welcome them aboard.
That's right.
That's good.
And feed should be a big one on there. That's going to be a big issue this year with the drought situation. We're down in our water. So hay did not come in, any of the dry farmed hay.
That's right.
So we're looking at that as being a big one. It'd be nice if somebody was growing hay, brought a truck and trailer load in. That'd be fabulous.
Wow, mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. That's a great idea. Mm-hmm. Well, I must say that I'm so grateful that both of you came in to speak with me today. I love what is being done there and the program, and I wish you both and the horses my best. I'm Donna Cheek with Issues and Ideas.
Hello, this is Brian Reynolds, San Luis Obispo County Library Director for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Radio. Joining me today are Dr. Mark Arnold, a local journalism professor and writer of science fiction. Welcome, Mark.
Hello.
Could you tell me a little bit about your career and background, Mark? What allows you to call yourself a journalist or a writer?
And why am I interested in science? I'd have to go a long way back, the old story about going back to your childhood. I was fascinated by space very, very early on. I remember going to a friend of ours' yard. Well, now this is the late 50s, early 60s, so interest in space was kind of natural given the space race at the time. We went to a friend of ours' backyard and watched Telstar go over.
Wow.
And after that, I think I watched every space shot launch until at least the 12th shuttle launch. So, yeah, I came by that naturally.
I remember a little bit about the late 50s and science and technology, but especially space exploration were big topics of the day.
Yeah, they sure were.
And that led you to journalism. How?
Well, you have a situation where one's father says you're never going to earn a living as a scientist because, let's face it, you simply don't have the mind. Perhaps you might want to try something easier like writing.
Huh. So you think writing is easy?
No, not at all.
So he fooled
you.
Well,
my father did.
Yeah, you know, it seems to me enjoying writing and reading that writing isn't so hard, but writing well would be the trick.
There you go.
To write concisely and keep people's interest. Do you think your interest in science fiction stems from that time period?
Oh, sure. Back then, I would read anything I could get my hands on. I remember going through Robinson Crusoe and La Mort d'Arthur. There were a number of science fiction books that were coming. Isaac Asimov at the time was, you know, the dean of science fiction. 80 Days Around the World. That was one of the early ones that I got into. And that type of thing just fueled my interest in it. The idea of speculative fiction, trying to figure out what's going to happen in the future and how it's going to affect people. Those have been big themes all through my life.
Could you define your definition of science fiction?
Yeah, sure. Technology and its effect on people within human situations and oftentimes extreme human situations.
You mentioned speculative, too, so I sense a direction of science and technology, but also the future.
Well, you have to figure out how many inventions have been predicted by science fiction. I love the idea that all of us hold our cell phones exactly the way that the people on Star Trek held their communicators when we have the speaker on.
We were talking just before we went on air about our respective timepieces. Today I'm wearing a wristwatch and you have a pocket watch. Certainly that was a bit of technology that affected human beings quite a bit.
Yeah, now we're going to get into academics, and I'm going to go a little bit academic on you.
Sure.
The theory is called technological determinism, and the classic example has always been the timepiece. How does it change society when we no longer say, I'll meet you before noon at an area versus I'll be there at 10? And that certainly is an example of how a technology strongly influences a society and an entire culture.
I read once that clocks were, at least in Western society, were used by religious folk to know when to pray when the sun was down in the middle of the night. If you had to get up at a certain time, you needed a clock to tell you to do that.
No, there's so many ancient timepieces, the candle clock, the water clock. By and large, though, we have lost through our changing recognition of a diurnal cycle.
People, 24 hours.
Right. Well, and our recognition of where we are within that cycle. People, many, many years ago, when they were more in touch with the out of doors, could tell you what time of night it was simply by the way the stars looked or by the condition of the sky.
You would think of tools like a watch or a computer as helping people, but it seems to me they don't always accomplish a purely benign effect.
The unforeseen effects of technology. Now, there's grist for a science fiction novel. What happens when someone comes up with an invention that has an effect that is quite deleterious on the rest of society? We certainly had the idea in the 1930s that nuclear power would be a wonderful benefit and boon to mankind. It's not quite turning out that way. I think there was that little incident during the end of World War II.
Yeah, I remember reading about some of the scientists who worked on it not being super thrilled with the idea of nuclear energy or even nuclear power used for bombs and killing people. And one has to think or surmise that those voices were muted. And what we heard was what the government wanted us to hear, that it was a wonderful thing either for peace or for industry and so forth.
Well, you're getting, again, into great grist for science fiction stuff. Remember the pressures on us to end that war and to use a weapon that is so unbelievably terrible that affects not just military targets, but the concept of total war, where we go to war against a population. Hitler did it to the people in London during the Blitz.
Right.
We did it with the Dresden firebombing.
Tokyo as well.
But when you say that the questioning by the scientists went unheeded, my immediate thought is to remember Oppenheimer's quote, when the first atomic bomb, the test bomb went off in White Sands, he said, "I am Shiva, the destroyer."
Wow. We'd like to remind everyone that this is Brian Reynolds, San Luis Obispo County Library Director for Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Public Radio for the Central Coast, joining me today for a fascinating discussion about literature and science and humanity is Dr. Mark Arnold, who is a journalist by trade and also in the process of writing a science fiction novel. I was going to comment that I think computers have changed things in huge ways and not always for the better. And one of the ways I jokingly talk about it is that computers never sleep, but people have to. And so how do you adjust your rhythm, your life's rhythm of the sun and the sunlight and the moonlight and darkness and sleep and eating and everything else we have to do with a machine that's essentially never off? My wife leaves her tablet on at home and her cell phone, and throughout the night I can hear it dinging, and it's ringing, and it's somebody playing Scrabble in the middle of the night with her. And so we're trying to sleep, but the machine is there, wakeful. It's kind of a creepy thing.
Yeah, it really is. I don't know, I'm going to go off on that a little bit because I think you're touching on something that's really important and something that I've thought many times. One of the tenets of science fiction, or one of the aspects of science fiction, has always been interspecies communication. I have to be careful here because that's also one of the things that divides fantasy from science fiction. And science fiction and fantasy have always gone together. Many times, certainly on stories like The Golden Compass, we have other species that are interacting with people. And we've had that in a number of other science fiction applications. What, however, happens when we create a species? One of the things that I was fascinated with during my doctorate was artificial intelligence.
Do you think the way I think about intelligence, I think not just about processing data, but judgment and intuition. Do you think those things are possible from a machine?
Yes. I think that when we begin to decipher the number of variables that a computer is using to make discernments, simple discernments. One of the greatest ones that I remember, this is 15, 20 years ago, is we were trying to teach computers to recognize an edge, mm-hmm. something an edge of something, to use binocular processors, visual processors, to detect the environment around you. But then in order to make a judgment, is that something that is the end of one thing and the start of another, or the end of one thing and the start of nothingness?
Wow.
That was 20 years ago. Now with a machine like IBM's Watson, which you may be – you're not a Jeopardy fan, are you?
No.
Watson was a computer developed by IBM and was used on the program Jeopardy as a contestant, and it had to process the answers in English, make a judgment based upon the wonderful multiple values that a single word has, and then come up with the correct answer.
This is Brian Reynolds, San Luis Obispo County Library Director for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Joining me today, Dr. Mark Arnold, journalist and science fiction author. Mark, I know you're writing a novel, and I know sometimes there's a jinx surrounding talking about your current work, but do you want to talk about your current novel that's in progress?
Sure. Not quite science fiction. I think technically the genre would be historical fiction, but it is about the creation of the very first science fiction novel, which was Frankenstein. It was written by a young girl. She was 18 when she wrote it and 19 when it was published. And I don't think there is a person out there who has read Frankenstein who would fail to mention just how horrific a novel it was. And yet it dealt with some amazingly adult ideas at the time. What is proper for man to do and not do? Do we do something because we can? Do we create life simply because we can? That was echoed in last month's National Geographic when we started looking at the ability that science now has to resurrect extinct species.
Right. And I know that I think technically the indicator of life is the ability to procreate and reproduce. And yet, I think viruses do reproduce, but they're not alive, supposedly.
Oh, you have to take on Jeff Carlson's work. He's just – now, there is a Central Coast writer who's making it very big in science fiction. Jeff Carlson wrote Plague Year, and the central theme of technology in Plague Year was the use of nanorobotic technology – the ability that very small robots have to replicate themselves.
Interesting. Is that a true fact? I mean, a science fact?
Oh, yes.
Wow.
In Jeff's novel, what he posits is a situation where a group of scientists were creating a nanobot that could be injected into the human body that would selectively cut out cancers. Unfortunately, it was released into the environment before it was ready and didn't stop with simply cutting out the cancer and began destroying mankind.
So this is a fictional?
His was fictional, yes. But the cautions are very, very real. I mean, if we take a look at most good science fiction, you'll find that there is a message, and that message is almost always, how do humans deal with technology?
Right now in the newspapers is an issue of the genetically modified grains like corn and wheat going on the wind and going to fields where they're not supposed to be there, or even foreign countries. And how does Monsanto's trademarks of a certain seed affect international trade or even human hunger issues?
Oh, yeah. And you're talking about the situation in Oregon where they discovered the genetically modified, I think it was corn.
Yeah.
That
in the wrong field.
In the wrong field. My journalism degree is from the University of Missouri, which has a very strong agricultural component. And so I became involved somewhat with the science and technology of agriculture as well. So this is how do we feed, what is it, 8 billion people now? How do we continue to feed the world's population when we're running out of space?
Well, and it's a global issue too. It isn't just about Monsanto's profit line.
No.
What do you see as the future of science fiction, briefly?
I like the now four genres of science fiction. I think they're going to expand and continue. Traditional science fiction, and most of my work is in traditional science fiction, the ability of people to go to different lands and survive and escape a world where technology has run amok. It seems to be that. But then you have two others. You have steampunk and you have cyberpunk, along with something called mundane science fiction, and I think that last one is the one that's really going to take off. The other two are primarily aimed at younger audiences.
Sounds like we have material for a whole nother show. Would like to thank you for joining us today. My name is Brian Reynolds, San Luis Obispo County Library Director for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Joining me has been Dr. Mark Arnold, journalist and science fiction novelist. Thank you, Mark.
You're welcome.